This recording is a production of Faith Builders. This presentation was recorded at Teachers Week 2013, held at Faith Builders on August 6 through 9.
I wasn't planning to be a teacher. In my first year of college, our school asked if I'd drop out and come teach. And since I was recently married and thought it would be more financially advisable to be making some money rather than spending money in the first year of marriage, I went ahead and dropped out, and don't you know, I found that I enjoyed it. And I've been teaching ever since. But it was in the ninth year that the bottom dropped out for me. It was a horrible year. We began the year with a lot of high hopes. We had a new teacher that was coming in with a lot of credentials. In fact, it's the most credentialed person I ever taught with. This person knew five languages, was one of the world's top authorities in Islamic law, and had been teaching in college, and the college closed, and so he wound up needing a job. He was a member of a Mennonite church, and from a state far from ours. And anyway, this church called us up and said, "Could you put this man to work?" And so we did. It turns out that it was a difficult year because the two of us really, really struggled. And by the end of the year, I was questioning whether the Lord had placed me in a wrong occupation. Actually, I was convinced that I shouldn't be teaching. It was good. I told someone it was good that that happened in my ninth year, because if it would have happened in my first year, the Lord would have found a different occupation for me. But that's not what I have in mind when I'm thinking about sinkholes and Christian schools. I think that it is very possible for us to go through all the motions of doing school, hiring teachers, enrolling students, purchasing textbooks, and so on a foundation that is no more reliable than a Florida sinkhole. I'm using sinkhole as a metaphor here today to describe the function, the activity of schooling without an adequate knowledge and understanding and wisdom to support it. Stable schools are built on a foundation that includes reliable, Christ-centered, biblically aligned answers to the fundamental questions that are at the base of education. And so today, what I would like to do in our first part is to take some of those fundamental questions and name them. I'd like to take the range of questions, condense it down to five biggies. And then in the second part, I'd like for us to take a look at how Jesus' words, when he quoted from the Old Testament Shema, how that actually helps to answer some of these questions. And so, the five foundational questions. Now, these are questions that we need to keep asking as long as we teach. I'm going to ask the questions today. I'm not planning to, in this section, to even give many answers. I just want us to set in the questions a bit. These are big questions. We all will have functional answers to these questions, but if we can name the questions so that we can actually reflect on them a bit and think on them, It gives God a chance to actually move us toward greater understanding, greater accuracy in our the way we answer those questions. And so that's what we want to try to do here together. So we'll begin. The first one, the question of what should we do? We have these children, these students. Well, what should we do with them? We know, we probably have a good grasp on what we do with them, but what should we do? Now, let's ask this in the bigger picture. Are we doing the right things? What we do, we sometimes call our mission. A number of years ago, there was a father, Douglas Wilson, in Moscow, Idaho. And his children were getting up to the age where he wanted to send them to school. So he started looking for a school to send them to. He started looking at what they did. And he looked at the public school, he looked at the Christian schools, and he wasn't really excited about what was happening, about what they were doing. And he started asking, is this really what should happen? He thought, well, maybe I should homeschool. What should I do to develop my children? And he came to the conclusion that nobody was doing what they should do, and so he developed a new approach. Actually, it was an old approach. It's called classical education. It's one of the fastest growing movements in Christian education today. It started by asking this question for him. What should we be doing? So some of the kind of the questions underneath it. You see, should our children actually study or should they work? Is it good for them to be spending 6, 8, 10 hours a day inside over books? What should we be doing with our children to help them grow and develop? What about this question of homeschool? Would it be best if what we did was have our children grow and develop in the home? Or is there a place for them to come together into a community school? This is a big issue for many of our communities. What are the pros and cons of each? Or what about the question of content versus relationships? See, what should we be doing? Should our schools be about just really giving our children rich, rich vistas of content? Or should they be a place where they learn how to live with each other? Now, I'm setting these up as either or, and we know that it's not that way. It includes some of both, but still the question can be, which one should anchor our efforts? Which one is a first, and which one then complements? Should our schools be teacher-centered? And it's about what the teacher knows and about what the teacher does. Or should we be student-centered? I was in sixth grade. Again, this is public school. They started an experimental program. They called it SPACE. It was the SPACE program. And they took some of the students out of the regular classes one day a week, and they said they were going to do something different with us. And so we went to space for a day. And what this was a student-centered approach to teaching. We would gather, and there was about 8, I believe, in my group. And the teacher would sit down with us and say, okay, what would y'all like to learn? And so we'd sit there and brainstorm, and we'd come up with all kinds of ideas, things we'd want to learn, and that's what we would study. So I remember that year, one of the things we did was we learned debate. We said, we think that would be something fun to learn, is debate. And so she took us to different places. Our teacher took us to different places where debates were going on, and we'd watch and observe, and then we had our own debates. We studied nuclear power that year. I remember also one of the things I was interested in was code breaking, code making and code breaking. And so the teacher said, well, you can, since no one else is interested in that, you can go off and study that yourself. And one of the things that I did was to make a film of the history of code making. I had little animated clay figures and would move them, take a few frames and move them again, take a few more. But I still have a lot of fond memories of that class. It was very student-centered. Now, I won't tell you some of the other things we studied because students aren't a very reliable group when choosing great things to study. But those were some of the better ones. How should we arrange our classes? What should we be doing? What classes should we teach? See, for a ninth grader, should it be algebra or should it be small engine repair? What should we do? A lot of questions fall under this category of our mission. Well, a second question. How should we do what we do? And this breaks into two subcategories. First would be methods. What methods are we going to use? Once we've decided what we should be doing, our mission, then we can be thinking about what are the best methods that we can use within that mission. So how can we best teach? But the other part of the how question has to do with values. What is non-negotiable? As we train children, as we educate, what values do we have that we will not compromise? So let's look at each of those. I'll just give one example maybe for each. So methods. Should we use groups in our education, or should it be much more individual? Now, this is just one of literally hundreds of questions in terms of methods. And then values. What is non-negotiable? Again, an example here would be knowledge or character. What should our schools be about? Should we say what we're going to have happen, regardless of if nothing else happens in our school, we're going to see that our students walk out of here with certain kinds of knowledge? Or do you value character more? That even if they don't learn Newton's three laws of motion, if they've developed a godly character, then we'll be successful. So what are the values that guide how we should do what we should do? You know, as I reflect back over the years of schooling that I've had and the different teachers, I see the teachers they go a lot of different places with both the methods and the values that they use. I remember fourth grade. I'll just stop right in fourth grade. Two teachers that I introduced you to. The one was Mrs. Sears. And Mrs. Sears was a no-nonsense teacher. She valued a quiet, orderly classroom. She valued all of her students working hard, studying hard. She also liked to smoke, and so she would go down to the teacher's lounge and take her smoke break. But she told us, now listen, when I come back, there are times, she didn't tell us what she was doing, but she said, and of course we knew, we said, there's times when I have to leave the classroom. And when I come back, I expect it to be just as quiet as it is when I'm here. And if it's not, then I'll have to, and she had a razor strap that she liked to use on her hands. And she said, it doesn't matter who it is or who's causing the problem, you all get a licking. Remember one time she came back and apparently that somebody was talking and she said, okay, everyone, put your hand out. So we had all sat there, all 30 of us with our hands out. And she'd walk around and whap, 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 and whap, whap, whap. And she got to me, and I don't know if I was feeling contrary or what, but I said, Mrs. Sears, I wasn't talking. And she said, Stephen, you need to understand that the world you live in, the good have to suffer with the bad. Mrs. Sears had values, she had methods that she used in her classroom. Now, another fourth grade teacher was quite different. Her name was Ms. Peebles. And her approach to education was that if you're going to learn, you need to be comfortable. You need to have a setting in which it's relaxed. And so what she lined her classroom with tables, and the tables were just mounded with all kinds of things that you may need in her classroom. She was a history teacher and an art teacher. And so the tables were full of art supplies, basically. And seats were kind of loosely arranged inside of those tables. The way she moved things around in her classroom was to throw it. And so if you needed glue, you would just say, you didn't have to put your hand up or anything, you just said, glue! And whoever was closest to it, you know, would pick it up and launch it in your direction. It was an interesting classroom. Remembering how she would give tests, she must have grown frustrated with our inability to learn, because she'd give a handout of the test questions. It had these blanks to fill in. And then she'd give a test bank on the board. She'd go up and write up all the answers on the board. And she put the answers in order. People still flunked her class. Ms. Peebles valued creative expression. And it showed in the way she ran her class. A third question. Why should we do it? Okay, really, this is much more fundamental than the other two. We tend to know what we do, and with a little bit of reflection, we can give some answers as to how we're doing what we're doing. The values we bring, the methods we bring to our classrooms. But what about this question of why? Why do we have schools? Why do we go through all of the effort? Talked to some school board chairmen recently in which they were telling me how many calls they had to make before they ever found a teacher for their schools. And it was obvious that they've put a lot of time and energy just into that one aspect of school. But why do we put all the money into it, all the time, all the energy? Why? Why do we do this? And why do we ask our children to spend this amount of time in a desk or in a school building for 8, 10, 12 years of their life? Why? What is a legitimate answer to that question? And then for each of us, why do we teach? Why do we do this rather than something else? I was, one of the things that I did in school was to take a program in electronic engineering. And toward the end of that program, I was offered two jobs. The one was in the field I was studying, electronics. And now this would have been 20 years ago. At that point, they said they would start me at $70,000. They would provide a vehicle, and that really it was kind of unlimited where I could go with pay. The other job was to teach at our church school, in which I won't say what I was offered. significantly less, with not a whole lot of expectation of that increasing. Now, why would I choose that? Why do you choose to invest your life the way you do? What is a why? What is a why that's big enough to support the kind of investment we're making, either as communities or as individuals in education? Fourth question, what kind of thing is my student? What kind of thing am I? If we need a fancy name for this, it's our anthropology. That's our view of man, view of mankind. How do we describe our student? If we're going to be teaching our student, we really ought to have a fairly good understanding of the kind of thing that we're going to be teaching. If we were running a school for dogs, we really ought to have an understanding of how you train dogs and the way dogs are put together and what they respond to and what they don't. Now, people are and do a lot of different things. People move. Does that mean that at our core we're movers? People think. Does that mean we are at heart thinkers? People create. Does that mean we're creators at our core? What is it that we really are? And maybe to help us ask this question, how is our student different from a rock? A rock exists, but how is a student different than that? How is a student different than a plant? Than an animal? How are we different? We could also ask how we're like, how we're similar to. What about an angel? How are we like or different from God? Now, James K. Smith, in his book, Desiring the Kingdom, says that most schools today tend to answer this question and say that at heart, people, students, are thinkers. And so what should a school do? It should train how to think. He says that Christian schools see the person as a little different, tends to see us as believers. So then, what's the role of the school? It's to give us or train us in what to believe. How do you see your students? What are they at core? Are they thinkers? Believers? It would be interesting to think, too, about how we as a people and maybe our schools see students. Our students, maybe we have a tendency to see students as moral, I'm going to use the word actors, and I don't mean someone from Hollywood. I mean someone who does things. You act. Actors. And therefore, our job is to train how to act appropriately. But are any of those the way we really are? Is that really at the heart of who we are? One other thing maybe I'll mention here. The dominant non-Christian way of seeing humans today is that humans are basically a collection, humans are a set of chemical reactions. Basically, we're rocks that have the ability for chemical reactions to create things like anger and thoughts and so on. Ray Kurzweil, one of the leaders in technological developments today. He's up there with the Bill Gates of the world. He's convinced that by 2050, we'll be able to continue to exist forever as a program on a hard drive or in a computer. Why would he say that with such confidence? Because the way he answers this question is to say that you and I are nothing more than the sum total of those chemical reactions that are taking place. And if we can duplicate those chemical reactions with software, you'll continue to exist that way. And these guys are serious. It's a view. It's the way they're answering the question of who, what kind of thing is my student. It's a question that's vital, and we need to think about it and think accurately about it. Number five, and the last of these five, what kind of place then is the world that we live in? We might say our answers to this is our worldview. What kind of place? And just very quickly, I want to explore it a little bit. Is the place we live in, is it a multiverse or a universe? Now, we grew up calling it a universe, but suspend that thought for a moment. Maybe we're in a multiverse. That is a world in which there is no ultimate connection between the different pieces. And so I'm using just kind of a shot of the sky to represent that. There's just all these random pieces of existence, but there's nothing that connects them. The alternative to that is to say, no, the kind of world we live in is a universe, that there is connection between it. That's what universe would mean. So this would be a part of this question of what kind of place. Another one is, well, what really is real in this world that we're in? Are thoughts what's real? You know, the things that go in our heads, is that what's real? Or are sensations, the things that we touch and taste and smell, what's real? A third aspect of this question, how do we reliably know anything about the world? See, is it through thinking about it that we know things reliably? Is it through studying it and observing it and using the scientific method? Is that the way we reliably find things about the world? Or is it revelation? Hearing from someone who knows the way it is. Five questions that are vital for us to wrestle with. Now, if we could turn our attention to Mark chapter 12, verse 28. One day, an educated Jewish leader who was carefully observing Jesus, he was observing the way he interacted with people. And he was impressed. He noticed that there were a number of difficult questions coming Jesus' way. And he said, I would like to run one of my questions by this man. It seems as if this man really wanted to know the answer to his question. We might call him a seeker today. And he was wrestling in the realm of these foundational questions. And this is what he asked. What really is important to do? What's vital to do? What's genuinely worth doing? Now, this is our why question. When we ask ourselves this, what's genuinely worth doing, it can be disconcerting, perhaps. It's a question we don't always, we just do things without necessarily asking whether they're really worth doing. I remember a conversation I heard one time with a person where they were asking him, he says, well, what do you do? He says, I work. He says, well, why do you work? He said, to make money. He said, well, why do you make money? And he said, well, it's because I need money to buy food. And so, well, why do you want food for? He said, well, so I can be healthy and live. And, well, why do you want to be healthy? He said, well, I can't work if I'm not healthy. what is really important to do? Existentialism and postmodernism are two ways of understanding the world today, prevalent ways of understanding the world, and both of those isms answer this question by saying nothing. Nothing is that important. There's nothing of ultimate significance to do. Now, for example, I think it's Francis Schaeffer that said, that illustrated this. He said, if you ask an existentialist what to do, if you come across an old lady who's getting ready to cross the road and you're in a car, you say, tell me, what is important to do in this situation? They would say, well, you could get out of your car and you could help her across the road, or you could speed up and run her over. And he would say, I can't tell you which of those you should do. The existentialist philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre said this: no finite point has meaning without an infinite reference point. No finite point, the thing I'm doing right now is a finite point. Eating breakfast is a finite point. Any one thing we do is a finite point. He says, without an infinite reference point, there's no way that those finite points can have any meaning. And that's precisely what this person is asking Jesus. Give me an infinite reference point. What is really, genuinely worth doing that can give meaning to all the other activity in my life? And Jesus answers, the most important thing to do is, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. What kind of answer is that? He was asking, what can I do that's important? And Jesus says, the Lord is one. Well, you know, sometimes when we ask the do, what should I do question. So if I ask one of my children to, say, take out the trash, the first time I ask it, you know what they ask back? Or it's easy to ask is, why? We want a reason for what we do. It's almost as if Jesus answers the why question before he answers the what we should do question. And the why question is because God, or the why answer here is because God is the greatest being in the universe. And all in the universe that is good and true and lovely and worthwhile is from God, it's for God, it's to God. There is no other. Let's stop looking for alternatives. The answer to your question is going to be found in God. And then he says, and you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength. There are three seeds in Jesus' teaching here. And that's the way God often gives us things. He gives us a seed, and that seed then can grow up and influence so much. So what are the three seeds here? The first one is the Lord is one, and these are seed answers. These are seeds that when we water them and grow them and think about them and so on, they really can grow up to answer some of those fundamental questions that we ask at the beginning. The Lord is one. Secondly, you shall love with your heart, your soul, your mind, and strength. And the third seed is love the Lord. I'd like to water these seeds in the remaining 10 minutes and see if they can sprout a little bit for us here in terms of our questions. So, the first seed, the Lord is one. Remember we asked the question, what kind of place is the universe? Is it a multiverse or a universe? Do you see how the seed that Jesus is giving us begins to answer this question? We're not used to thinking in terms of a multiverse, but at the time, in the Old Testament times, they were. In fact, this is just a few of the gods that the people in Old Testament times in the Middle East would have understood to be in existence. And so you have a god for war, a god of the sea, the stars, the storms, and so on. And these gods are not necessarily connected. And if you want to learn how to navigate life, you're going to have to be in touch with a whole lot of different gods. This is a vision of a multiverse. And it is to this understanding that Deuteronomy, the Shema, that Jesus is quoting here, when God says, "The Lord is one," it's speaking in this context. So the alternative view of the universe might look something like this, that all of those different aspects of life are tied into, connected to God. An understanding of how the sea connects to God is not something that is just native to us. It is something that needs to be cultivated. And as teachers, I believe this is one of our primary jobs, is learning to understand how all of reality fits with God. The Lord is one. Beautiful passage here in Colossians. He, Jesus, is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation, for by Him all things were created in heaven, on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authority, all things. All things were created through Him and for Him. He's before all things, and in Him all things hold together. He's the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in everything He might be preeminent. For in Him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell, and through Him to reconcile to Himself all things, all things, all things. The Lord is one. What kind of place is the world? Romans 11 says it this way, from Him and through Him and to Him are all things. That's the kind of world we live in. The studies that we do every day in our classrooms are connected to God. It's our job to make that connection, to understand that connection, to make that connection. And so, you see, one of the things we do as teachers is we take and we divide all of the things into categories like math and science and history and geography and so on. And we do that because that's the way we have to do in order to learn. We have to divide. We have to categorize. But if our job stops here, we're missing a critical component of Christian education. And that is to show how they all fit back together with God. The Lord is one, and everything that is comes from Him and is for Him and is to Him. Now that's an exciting opportunity we have as educators. By the way, I would offer the book, it's in your resource list there at the end, Reclaiming the Future of Christian Education, as a way to help flesh out some of this. The Lord is one. Quote here from Harry Blamires. He says, a living Christian mind, notice a mind that is thinking Christianly, would elucidate for the young, for our students, a finely articulated Christian sacramentalism. Big word to speak of God's connection to all that He has made, which would make sense of and give value to the adolescent's cravings toward the grandeur of natural scenery, towards the potent emotionalism of music and art, and towards the opposite sex. See, these are realities that we feel. God and a Christian understanding can explain these things. It's our job as educators to offer those, to understand them ourselves, and to offer that kind of explanation. I'm going to skip this and go on to the next seed. You shall love, Jesus says, heart, soul, mind, and strength. This seed is full of meaning for the question, what kind of thing is my student? And to talk about that, let's just remind ourselves that being and doing are interrelated and interconnected. Who I am and what I do are not something that can be separated. Doing affects being, being affects doing. Someone has said we are or we become what we repeatedly do. Now, if Jesus said the most important thing about us is that we should think true thoughts about God, that would suggest that we are at core thinkers, right? If Jesus said the most important thing you can do is to believe and trust in God, that would suggest that maybe at core, we're believers. But what does he say? The most important thing for us to do is love, which says at heart, you and I and our students are lovers. What kind of thing are we? We are at core lovers, the kind of thing that loves. Now, if this is true, it would be irresponsible for you and I as teachers to ignore the impact that our teaching is having on the loves of our students. See, we're hired to teach knowledge and skills and so on, but you can't do those kinds of things without impacting the loves. And so as teachers, we're going to have to, this is a realm in which we're going to have to pay attention and we're going to have to work. Now, Jesus says that that you need to love God, and you love him with heart, soul, mind, and strength. We are not at core minds or souls. We are at core lovers. That's the kind of thing we are. These other things are capacities in which we can use to love. And we will love things, and our students will love things. So the question is, what are we loving? This gives a whole new way of evaluating what I'm doing as a teacher. Maybe one of the things I ought to put on my lesson plan template is, how will this lesson shape the loves of my student? See, it's not enough to merely teach a child how to read. We have to pay attention to what is it that they're loving in their reading. It's not enough to teach how to add fractions. What is it that they're loving with their math skills? And then finally, the seed, love the Lord. I believe this answers this question of why. Why should we do what we do? The primary purpose of all of life, including education, is to be and to nurture lovers of God. And I would define a Christian teacher as a person who, from their own love for God, nurture other lovers of God. Why am I teaching? It may be because I enjoy it. It may be because I want to help my students learn and so on. But what needs to undergird all of our teaching is a love for God and a desire to love him by nurturing that love in my students. Why do we have schools? When the driving motivation for why we go to all the work that we do, when the driving motivation is because we see school as absolutely critical to the process of raising a generation of people that love God, that's when there will be a revival in our schools. It's okay to teach because students need this in order to go into business, or it's okay to teach in order to help our students become more intelligent and know more things. But it's not until we're doing all this, because we can hardly imagine a better way in order to cultivate a love for God. That's why we do school. Love God. We are out of time, and so I'm going to just skip here to a summary. Our work as teachers includes loving God ourselves. We're not going to cultivate love in our students if we don't love him ourselves. Secondly, it involves shaping an environment that nurtures love for God and our students. This is a tremendous amount of work here for this to happen, but that's what we're called to. And third is understanding, living, and demonstrating the real connections between all things and God. Christian education is more about what students love than what they know.
For more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit thedocforlearning.org.